Live from a banker box outside of Castle Rock Entertainment, this is the 102nd episode of Austin Danger Podcast, the only randomly curated Austin Powers podcast on the internet. I'm Kev, and as always, I'm joined by super producer extraordinaire Mackenzie Wilkes.
Howdy, howdy.
Yes, friends, Castle Rock Entertainment is the company created by Rob Reiner, the director of our 100th episode, This is Spinal Tap. And they've closed before, but not before producing the film we're talking about tonight, Rob Reiner's North. It's a movie. It was released in 1994. It stars Elijah Wood. Mm-hmm. And in the second half of the show, we will be discussing it. So, fun.
Wish us luck.
That's all I have to say until we get there. So...
Oh, I'm filled with fear.
Oh, God. But before we do that, I just wanted to remind people real quick that you have another 3.5 weeks to participate in the second annual Austin Danger Podcast Awards for Excellence in Cinematic Arts and Crafts, a.k.a. the Austins, a.k.a. the Stainies. We have already received a ton of votes. Thank you, everybody who has come out and voted already. It is a fascinating race, and not to give it away, there's still time to change the story. There's still time to have your voice be heard in many of the more categories, honestly, than I figured. I thought we had you guys down pat.
No, it's like split a lot in ways I didn't anticipate, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, and this is a situation where... How else should I put this? I'll put it this way. One vote really could change the whole show. So again, please follow the link in the show notes. Vote in the Stainies. Say you voted. Make yourself a sticker if you want with like a little Austin Powers on it saying, Groovy Baby, even though Austin is a devout socialist, I'm sure that he would love it.
I forgot. About that. Love that ref. Love that deep cut ref, Kev.
This is the only randomly curated Austin Powers podcast on the internet. I'd be remiss in my duties if I didn't.
If you didn't, yeah.
If I didn't know, yeah. That's right. Just like all the jokes from North I memorized over the weekend.
Oh, wow.
Can I just say, I'm sorry. I have to say something. So
say everything, please.
No show last week. Totally fine. Life finds a way.
Yeah.
Reminds to Austin Nation, the show's free. But the problem is that last week we would have recorded on January 31st. And what happened was North was on Tubi on January 31st. And then on February 1st, no North. And I had half an hour left in the movie to watch. Very long, which in regular people time is about 2 hours and 45 minutes. So I had to rent North to watch the last half hour of North. And I just want people to know I'm not happy about it. And this was already 3 marathon sessions of trying to get through North.
This movie is less than 90 minutes and it took you 4 sessions.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things you could blame. One of which is North. But another thing you can blame it on is that you and I have become hopelessly addicted to a show on everybody's favorite streaming service. Tubi let me down. Voodoo picked me up for a price. Mm-hmm. Tubi let me down. But our favorite streaming service, of course, is Peacock.
Yes. Are you replacing Apple TV Plus as the official
AP streamer? Wait a minute. No, we already did this, right? No, it is absolutely Apple TV Plus. Apple TV Plus announced Michael Douglas in Benjamin Franklin last week,
by the way. Your
which
obsession
is the
now.
Most Kev-coded shit in the universe. And it's going to air at the exact same time as the miniseries about the manhunt for John Wilkes Booth after President Lincoln's assassination.
Yo, what?
I'm calling it right now Kev Block. This is going to be the best 2 hours of weird, far out stuff you'll ever see. And they'll be played totally straight. So that'll be fun. All this to say, the Traitors, Peacock, Thursday nights. We are parked in front of the TV. Alan Cumming, He comes out and he goes, "Good morning, Slater."
Is that your Scottish accent?
And the faithful. The faithful and the
I'm just here to look fabulous. His little baby curl, and his it's not what will be the listener's last episode, but the episode
before.
I've got
the front locks of my hair tucked outside of my head.
Yeah, it's so great.
Yeah, his little duck. We were obsessed with his little duck tail.
Yes, to everyone, we're recording the week before. So like whatever the latest episode to you is, we're watching, Kevin and I are watching that tomorrow, and we are talking about the latest episode, which I had a couple sick days last week, so both podcasts were obviously off, and I took that time while I was laying in bed sick to binge The Traitors, because I was hearing that season two was pretty good. I watched all of UK season one, because I do love the host over there, and thought it was fun. I just wanted to get a vibe, and then I switched over to season two of America, and when I was in college, I was really into Big Brother. Like, I was really obsessed with the season that was airing when I was in college. I don't recall which one it was. And I was always texting my friends about shit. I was following all these Twitter accounts that were doing live updates of the feeds. I watched the feeds myself. I was obsessed with Big Brother for a long time. It took a little bit too much of my mental capacity, which is why I kind of stopped. But I always liked kind of fun social games like that. It's kind of amazing I never gave Survivor a shot, though. Watching Parvati on this season has made me want to maybe check out Survivor too. But yeah, man, I mean, Dan, I he's one of the most epic Big Brother players of all time. I watched his season where he won season 10, one of the best Big Brother seasons ever. I think unanimously people believe that, but, not to spoil it, but I have, he fucked up. He played so badly. It's weird that like one of the best Big Brother players of all time was so bad at The Traitors. It's kind of amazing.
Without giving too much away, I do want to say that it looks like he just tried to apply the Big Brother playbook to that Slater's. And the problem is that it's just a different game.
It's a different game.
A different game. For folks who don't know, The Traitors is mafia, werewolf, etc., where it's a bunch of people in a remote area, usually a castle, and like, no joke, a castle. And three of them will be the traitors, and the rest will be the faithful. And it'll be the job of the faithful to determine the traitors by voting them out Survivor style at the end of every episode. Then at the end of the night, they did the voting thing. And then at the end of the night, the traitors get together in like a secret passage, which is hysterical. It's all in the US version. It's all played for goofy.
Very
high
dramatic.
Camp.
Yeah.
Alan is Alaning.
Yes. He's amazing. He's so good.
The phrase I'll use is Alaning, although I'm sure he would love the alternative. They vote on somebody to kill, like Mafia. You remember Mafia, that you open your eyes and whatever. So without getting into the details and the nitty gritty of it, this season is what I wanted out of the first season of Traitors.
I'm hearing that a lot. Yeah.
They got more, they were smarter about picking a nice group of people to create housewife-esque drama, and there are real housewives on the show,
yes,
and etc., who know what to do to get airtime, which is to yell and scream and turn little things into stupid stuff, and frustrating sometimes. It gets in the way of the game early this year in a way I really didn't love, but there's that. If you're into the drama, there's the drama, and then if you're into the machinations and the gameplay, they have Big Brother alums, Survivor people, and just really calculated traitors, or so we thought. And then, you know, they'll walk into bear traps and whatever. It's a really fun one. I highly recommend it. I don't watch a ton of these reality shows, but this one is dope. It's this and Deal or No Deal Island also coming to Peacock.
It's a blast. I mean, yeah, like with Dan especially, like someone pointed out, I think very accurately, that Big Brother, like 90% of the gameplay in Big Brother is downtime, because they are just living in a house. And so like, it's better to be quiet and fade and make friends and just kind of hang out, which in The Traitors, it's like, it's literally every single day. Every episode is a day. You know what I mean? Like, this game is flying. It's theoretically over in 2 weeks. And so I feel like, because of that, you can't play a quiet game like someone like Dan does. You have to be loud. You have to be making alliances. You have to be really not making yourself look guilty, which he did. And yeah, the other traitors have been really, really, really fun. Love Parvati. interested. I'm interested to see what's going to happen. We're you all, if you're watching, will have seen what's the aftermath of last episode, but they finally got one of the traitors out. It was probably one of the most intense table sessions they've had because, I mean, I've already said it, Dan, he tried to throw out a big play and it backfired completely. And I think some of the best television of the season so far was that 20 minutes at the table. And I am exhilarated to see tomorrow how they're going to come back from that, because I'm really curious how the other traders can survive after that kind of, that, like, Dan just threw a dynamite into the pot and left.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting to come back after the season is over, maybe do an ADP ADP, bring back that legendary segment that 70 millimeter stole from us, and talk about the season in detail, because there is a part of me that wants to believe that the game is over.
Mm.
And that the way, I'm trying to be very careful here, but the way that play was done and the way it was fumbled may have actually won the game for somebody in the long run, but we'll have to see. I think the other person in this scenario, who I know you like, is out. I think it's maybe this week. Maybe this week.
I know.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's that they're next. It's very obvious.
If they survive this week, that's going to be a big comeback, and I'm going to be very impressed. And my fingers and toes are crossed, because I would like them to survive.
I agree. I would be very impressed. I'm here for it.
I think that the power move that person made at the end of the episode in terms of recruiting a new traitor is,
yes,
might be what saves them. I don't know. Or might be what kills them. Who knows?
It may be what saves her. One false move from that particular person and they're done. So who's to say?
But yes, I have saved a fan cam of her. So, you know, I'll always have her on my phone.
That's the traitors. The idea, let me tell you something also, while we're in Tangent City, the gameplay of Big Brother, the winning of Big Brother, the idea that you can win, that there's a game to win, that fascinates me. I can't say I've ever watched like a full season of Big Brother.
I think that, like, not every season is great. Like, even when I was watching in college, it was kind of a stinker of a season. But, like,
sure,
it used to be kind of just people hanging out in a house. And then, like, when Dan came in, he was sort of the person who introduced the idea of, like, actual strategy to it. And I think that's why many people consider his season to be one of the greatest seasons ever, because it's just hard. Because Janelle's also on that season, who's in this season, The Traitors, as well. And Dan won that season. Janelle didn't. I don't know. Big Brother, it's hit or miss, but if you look up which seasons are good generally, or people consider good, if you like that kind of gameplay, it's fun. It's mostly social, but there's also, they do physical challenges, obviously, to win immunities and to win power in the household. So, like, it still mixes that blend of survivory physical stuff too. So maybe I'm preaching to the choir. Maybe everybody that listens to ADP watches Big Brother, but yeah, I was into it for quite some time. I've definitely fallen off, and I think the traders are scratching that itch now, which is nice.
Man, am I getting into competition reality TV again?
I want to try Survivor. I really do.
I watched a season and a half of Survivor and then fell off because there are many reasons, but mostly, like, the episodes would come out and then they would, like, be on Paramount Plus, and then I would just never watch them. And then a week would go by, and I don't have 2 hours to watch Survivor. I have 1 hour. So it's tough. And now every episode's 90 minutes, so what the hell? Mm. But if you wanted to get into it, I could totally get into it, and we could ruin this podcast and turn it into a Survivor thing.
Well, until we decide we want to get into Survivor, I love the idea of revisiting ADP ADP at the end of the Traitor season. Interested to see how it'll shake out. I pretty much always root for the traitors in this game because I think I would like being a traitor. So I always root for the traitors. So let's see what happens tomorrow. I will be sat for tomorrow's episode. So
I'm too anxious to be a traitor. I just couldn't do it.
I think I'd be good at selling it. I really do. I think I'd be good at selling myself as a faithful because I think I have a trusting face and people like me, which sounds conceited, but, like, I feel like I'm a likable person, and I feel like I could social game myself into being trustworthy to people while I stab them in the back.
Man, I would actually be a pretty damn evil traitor. That's pretty funny.
Anyway, another thing we both checked out before I got sick and didn't watch anything but TV for a week. We both checked out some Sundance Online stuff. We hit up Sundance. Let's get into it.
Yeah, we did a Fancy Dance, not to be confused with the new Apple film Fancy Dance. By the way, Apple TV Plus, the official streaming service of Austin Danger Podcast. How about that pickup? Good job.
Yes, Lily Gladstone. Yes.
We watched a couple movies.
Yeah, so I feel like we both watched one that was the same, and we each watched one that was the other one didn't. So should we start with the film we both watched, which was Between the Temples?
Yeah. Yes, let's talk about this. Still not picked up, I don't think.
Which breaks my heart.
Recording time, which is nuts because it's a winner. At least, like IFC, nothing like feels totally in line with their shit. I don't get it.
For everybody to just get a vague overview of this film, this is directed by a guy named Nathan Silver, who's directed a few little films. I haven't checked out any of his other work, but this is stars Jason Schwartzman and the great Carol Kane, as well as Dolly de Leon, who, if you liked Triangle of Sadness, which I didn't, I still liked Dolly de Leon in Triangle of Sadness because she's incredible. And it's about, he plays kind of a depressed cantor whose wife recently died. And he finds himself unable to sing and perform his duties, and he's just depressed and wants to not be on this earth anymore. And he ends up reconnecting with his old music teacher from middle school or elementary school. And it takes a lot of specificity, I think, of Jewish culture, but there was a time for bat mitzvahs are more new in terms of certain Jewish cultures. And so she's an older woman, so she never had a bat mitzvah because when she was turning 13, they weren't a thing, presumably, in her temple. And so she wants to now have a bat mitzvah at the age of 80. I believe she's 80 or she's maybe 70. She's older woman than him, definitely. And it's about their relationship and them connecting. And I fucking loved this movie so, so, so much.
Yeah, it's great. It has a great feel, a great sense of humor. Performances again, like this is just such a winner. I love this film.
I was so in love with Carol Kane the whole time. I mean, I love Carol Kane, period. Mm-hmm. I think she's amazing, but possible future ADP legend. I mean, what movies do we need to get this woman legend status?
Carol Kane, eh?
Carol Kane. I mean, look, we got Confessions of a Teenage Drama Queen. We got Jawbreaker.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. Never
seen
it.
Dog Day Afternoon. She's Princess Bride.
She's in Dog Day.
She's thing. Grandma in Adam's Family part. Values. She takes over the role of Grandma in Adam's Family Values.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, she's in Joe vs.
Transylvania 6500. 6500. This is a great film.
She's uncredited in Man on the Moon. That's very funny.
Well, there you go.
She's incredible. I love her. She's amazing. Her and Schwartzman have incredible chemistry. Schwartzman had a huge year last year. He is really just like such a consistently great actor. Like everything he picks, I love. Like he's just someone who I just show up and I see him in something and he's amazing in it. And usually it's a film that I adore. And yeah, like him and Carol together are amazing. The supporting cast is really funny. Yeah, it's shot in a really weird way, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, it has this like indie feel.
Home video. It's very shaky home video, very close on people's faces. I could see a lot of people being so alienated by the way it looks because it's not a film you're coming to for gorgeous cinematography. It is just like very close images of people's faces. But I don't know. It felt intimate and awkward in the way I think was intended for the piece. Rachel made a joke. It's kind of filmed like a VHS tape of a bar mitzvah almost. Like it kind of has that awkward. I related it to Shiva Baby in my review because it also uses this style to build tension in social situations, which is a big part of the film. And yeah, I don't know, I think about it a lot. Since I watched it, I think about it at least once a day, and I'm dying for someone to pick it up so that I can know down the road I can check this movie out again because I really, really loved it.
I do want to note the cinematographer of the film is Sean Price Williams. He shot another film. He directed The Sweet East, which came out this last year, which has been kind of going through the indie circuit. And it has a very similar kind of old school feel, at least judging by the trailer. He also shot all of the films by Alex Ross Perry, who's like a blank check guest and a great director in his own right, as well as Funny Pages.
Oh, wow.
Years ago, which was a great movie we talked about on this show. And Good Time, which I think people saw.
I mean, yeah, maybe it's the Safdies, right?
Maybe they saw it. It is.
I mean, yeah.
So yeah, he does this close-up thing. He's kind of dabbling in this retro look, but I think ultimately it works.
I think it's like, I feel very confident about my comparison of it's the Holdovers meets Shiva Baby. And I only said the Holdovers in terms of, yeah, it has vintage feel visually, and also it's about relationships. Like, it's much like the Holdovers to me. What makes that movie beautiful is it's just about relationships, and it's about opening yourself up to care about other people. And that's ultimately what Between the Temples is also. And then it also has the Judaism and anxiety of Shiva Baby. So you put those together and you get Between the Temples.
Sure. And a great supporting performance by Robert Smigel, the guy behind Triumph the Insult Comic Dog as the rabbi. Totally unexpected. Did not expect this guy. So that was great. I was shocked.
Oh my gosh, it's really good. But you also checked out, tell me about the film you checked out that I didn't. You watched Thelma, correct?
Oh yeah, we watched this movie called Thelma, which is a really great debut. It's an indie comedy debut. Whenever you Google just Thelma, it comes up with a 2017 movie that is quite different.
Yes.
The legendary June Squibb plays Thelma Post, who's like this 93-year-old grandma who falls for one of those internet phishing scams. And so it's up to her now to get the money. So she sent like a bunch of money in cash to a scammer. And now it's up to her to get that money back. So she teams up with the late Richard Roundtree. This is a posthumous release, one of his final performances, as he died last October. And they're going to go find the money, and chasing Thelma and Richard Roundtree are the great Fred, I'm going to say Heckinger, as the grandson, as this kind of ne'er-do-well grandson who's misunderstood. And the parents are potential future ADP legend Parker Posey. And listen, if we get there, ADP legend Clark Gregg,
whoa!
If we ever do Avengers on this show, he will become an ADP legend, Clark Gregg, as the parents, who are very funny and have like they have a great rapport. It's all very simple, but all very silly. I don't want to say much more about the story because it's a big surprise. And there are big names advertised in this film that I forgot about in watching it, and were big surprises and are funny in their own right. So that's all I'll say. But it's very funny. It is also kind of the plot of the movie The Beekeeper with Jason Statham. Because it's a person trying to get revenge on a phone scammer. But it is funnier and much better. I five banged this. Magnolia bought it, so they picked it up. What I want to say is you should absolutely see it. It may be a while.
I want to see. I am regretting not getting a ticket to it, and maybe we'll talk about it after I share my little blurb about the film I checked out. But I'm like committed to getting a pass next year so that I can check out more films, because just the two I watched, even though I hated one and I loved one, it still made, and I was so jealous that you got to watch Thelma, it made me ravenous to watch more. So I think next year I'm really going to commit to getting a pass and like setting my weekend aside to watch some movies.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, there's really nothing to add. Yeah, I don't really have anything to add. It is a cool thing to do.
I'm down for Sundance next year. I will say quickly, the one I watched outside of Between the Temples was Handling the Undead, which I just blind bought like a psycho. I just saw that it was the actors from Worst Person in the World. Renate Renzva and Anders Danielsson Lai, incredible actors from Worst Person in the World. And
that's
then
how they getcha.
I blind bought that, and then I watched the trailer and I said, I don't think I want to watch this, but I already paid $26 for it. And
oh my god.
I mean, those are the individual tickets, or $25 a pop. That's why I'm like, if the pass itself is a bit of a deal, like I think it's worth it for sure. But yeah, I think Neon picked up or already had Handling the Undead, so you will, much like Magnolia, you will see it eventually. I don't fucking know when, but you will see it because Neon has it. I've had a few mutuals who really, really loved this. But most of my mutuals, including myself, did not like this film at all. I thought it was just sort of oppressively slow and sad. It is a Norwegian film, I believe. Norwegian film about it's kind of vignette-y almost. Like there's three different groups of people, an older woman and her wife, kind of middle-aged couple with two, three kids, and then a single mother with a father and a son. And each of them experience someone dying. So the older woman, her wife dies, the kind of middle-aged couple, the wife gets in a car wreck and dies, and then the single mom, her son dies, or he was recently dead. So he was buried. And they're all kind of at different stages of being dead, kind of, either being buried, just had their funeral, or just got in the wreck. And it's just kind of about something happens, ? An electrical field is what it's described as, I think, on Letterboxd. And these people come back to life, but they are essentially zombies and decaying, and it's fucked up. And it's kind of just about the people in their lives trying to understand why their loved ones are suddenly alive again, while also grappling with the fact that these aren't really their loved ones. These are shells of their loved ones. And I don't know. I like movies about grief, but this just did nothing. Again, it just was so slow. There's basically no dialogue in it. Again, I like the experimental nature of it. Like, I like that there's pretty much no dialogue. Cinematography is gorgeous. The sound design's immersive. The design elements are great, but those poor actors, they have like nothing to work with. And it's one note. It is so deeply one note, and it drones on that one note the whole time. And by the end you go, why did I watch that? Nothing actually happened to make me care about these people. It didn't make me reflect on my own experiences with loss. It just didn't seem to have purpose. And I was definitely disappointed by it. So that's a little bit of a lower note to end on, but I don't know if I would recommend Handling the Undead if and when you're able to see it. But if you like the actors in it, I'd, you know, check it out. But it was definitely a letdown. Between the Temples was the winner this year for me.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think it's so great and very indicative of the experience of a music festival like Sundance, is that you can have a really amazing experience with a movie people may never see, or you may have a terrible experience with something everyone will have to pretend to like in 10 months. There's a wide range of things.
Mm.
And I love Worst Person in the World. I want it to be clear.
Yeah, me too. That's why I got the ticket. But damn.
Listener, you may feel obligated to love that film, and you don't have to.
Yeah, it's not very good. Between the Temples is great. Next year, I want to get a pass, but I'm looking at the clock. And Kev, speaking of movies we're going to have to pretend to like in 10 months.
Whoop-dit news. What does it all mean, Basil?
Well, I want to start Austin News this week, folks. This is Austin News, the segment where we talk about all the news in the world of Austin Powers, with a story that is not connected to Austin Powers directly, or is it?
Hmm.
A couple weeks ago, the Sony Pictures lot, they have dedicated their music building to the great John Williams.
Oh.
Especially their studio where many of the great scores were recorded on the Sony Pictures lot. It's pretty amazing to think about. Luis DiTullio, Malcolm McNabb, they're playing.
Hell yeah, hell yeah.
They're playing in this legendary studio dedicated to John Williams. It's amazing. And Steven Spielberg and his son, J.J. Abrams, were there to celebrate.
Oh my God.
But it's amazing. You look at these movies, E.T., Jaws, Saving Private Ryan, Indiana Jones series, all past and future episodes. It's staggering to think about the legacy of this man and his flautists and tuba players or whatever.
Sorry, I got distracted by a Yard Barker article. Did you see this? Of 20 facts you might not know about Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery.
You know, it's crazy you mentioned that, Mackenzie, because the next story is an article from yardbarker.com. 20 facts you might not know about Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery. And I'm happy you have it open and are totally focused, because now we have to go through every single fact.
They're not good.
We're gonna go through them quickly. Yeah, I know they're not good. It's the whole point of this segment. But so let's go. number one, Mike Myers created the character for a weird side project.
We know about that.
He created it for the band Ming-T. We knew that. The Hoffs connection may have gotten the director involved. Susanna Hoffs, who was in Ming-T, was Jay Roach's wife. We know that. Myers made it for his father. We know that. Myers originally was not going to play Dr. Evil. He wanted Jim Carrey.
I didn't know this, actually.
I would love for this.
Is there a source? Yeah, I was about to say, is there a source for that?
First of all, of course, this is yardbarker.com. What do you think this is? The New York Times? There's no source on that. Source Reddit.
Oh, yeah, that sounds.
Okay,
they're saying it's
the wiki. Reddit sends me to the wiki. Let's see. Now I'm on splitsider.com. Okay, splitsider.com, I'm willing to believe more than yardbarker. All right. Rhea Perlman and Colin Quinn were going to play Frau and Scott Evil. Colin Quinn was going to play Scott Evil.
Okay.
What would that have been like?
That would have been weird. That would have been weird.
It would have been Irishman tier. his point here, he cast Robert Wagner and Michael York as old school actors. They call it a Quentin Tarantino thing.
Okay.
It was credited with revitalizing the careers of both actors.
Sure.
So that's good. Rob Lowe almost played number two.
He did. Well,
this is stupid. Rob Lowe was almost in the series sooner because he's in a deleted scene. He's in the henchman birthday scene. We knew that. Will Ferrell's film debut. We obviously knew that.
Yeah.
Dana Carvey was annoyed by the movie. Because Dr. Evil is based on his impression of Lorne Michaels.
Oh, okay.
You know, Dana Carvey, respectfully, you got your movie, and one day we'll do Master of Disguise on the show. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of improv is number 10.
Oh my God.
Which is like number 11. This is insane. Pam Anderson maybe could have been in it. I actually didn't know that.
Okay, I think that's fake because they said at the Hulu series Pam and Tommy is to believe there is a I didn't
oh,
finish.
We talked about this.
I don't think
we
it's
debunked
true,
this.
Right? Yeah, it's because like they put it in that shitty Pam and Tommy series I watched in like two episodes of that she's auditioning to be Vanessa, but I don't think that's real, right? Like, didn't we debunk
Correct.
That when it came out?
That was debunked. Yard Barker, come on, man,
stupid.
And you could have called it 19. You know, you don't do round numbers in the listicles because then people don't believe you. Like, we're not believing you. Number 11, Pam Anderson, debunked. Number 12, Neil Mullarkey is the guy who says penis and larger pump.
We know this.
Great. Number 13, America Online was product placement, and they gave him a free year of service, which I think this may be a misinterpretation of a joke in the DVD commentary. So thanks for that. Mr. Bigglesworth's real name, and it's in a link.
Yeah, they make you go to an outside website.
For an article, Mr. Bigglesworth Exposed, from 1999 on the Chicago Tribune.
Fucking hilarious.
And the cat's name, oh man.
Impossible to find in this article.
No, I got it. In real life, Mr. Bigglesworth is named, this is so bad, Ted Nugent, Nudegent, because he is a nude gent. And if you Googled Ted Nugent, you wouldn't be naming your pets after this gentleman, respectfully.
Well, there was also Ted shares screen time with a new character, Baby Bigglesworth, played by three kittens who are named Mel Gibson, Skin Deanna Jones, and Paul Nudeman. So we're about 50% named after problematic people in regards to these cats so far.
Yo, Skin Deanna Jones.
Skin Deanna Jones and Paul Nudeman.
Number 15. In the opening of the first film, there's a woman named Rita dressed like a meter maid. That's a Beatles reference. Number 16, Austin's glasses are an homage to the Ipcress file, Michael Caine's character in that film, which we will one day cover on the show. And you're going to love morale. If you thought morale was high on the North episode, the Ipcress file. Number 17, it influenced the Bond franchise. We talked about this.
Last three are comically bad, Kev. They're bad.
Okay. Number 18, the movie was a surprise hit. Again, like,
facts you might not know about a movie we're writing about 20 plus years after
they
it came
made
out.
Movies about
it was
them,
a surprise
bro.
Hit.
Man, this guy probably fought really hard to do 14. This guy was like, bro, I got like 14 solid ones. They're not solid, and one of them's a lie, but he's got like 14 ones you could publish.
Take a peep at 19.
Okay. here we go. I'm covering the screen so as to maximize the surprise because it's got built up for me and in the edit.
This is a fact you might not know. Facts you might not know about Austin Powers.
You gotta be fucking joking, dude.
I'm not. Say it, Kev. Say it. Say it.
Austin Powers facts you may not know. Number 19, there were two sequels.
There were two sequels?
Could you believe that? They're saying Goldmember, they're saying Shagged Me made $312 million worldwide, which is what a Marvel flop does these days. And that Goldmember made $296, which isn't bad either. Oh, number 20.
That's honestly not bad.
Hey, here's something to think about. Number 20, there might be a fourth film.
Okay, fuck off. Yardbarker. Yardbarker's on my shit list now.
I didn't realize that a fact was something that might happen.
Anyway, we're almost 45 minutes into the North
episode. Yeah, man.
Should we talk about North?
Yeah, let's talk about it. You ready for me to do North? Here we go.
The smoothest transition of all time.
North is a precarious and charming young boy who can't get a word in edgewise at the dinner table. His parents, literally half the cast of Seinfeld, wrapped up in the tangle of their own lives, aren't even looking at him most of the time. Embittered by this and encouraged by his new friend, Bruce Willis, the Easter Bunny, North decides to divorce his parents and become a free agent son. You know, like in baseball. He retains Arthur Belt, a skeevy lawyer, to oversee the proceedings and enlists his best friend Winchell to report on it for the school paper. But little does he know, these two heels might be in cahoots. What ensues is a series of sad, weird, racist episodes where North finds himself in a new home with a new set of parents and new problems. These include Ma and Pa Tex, who perform an elaborate parody of the Bonanza theme that explains that they are looking to replace their son Buck, who passed away. Second time in as many years that that idea has come to Austin Danger Podcast after Bo is Afraid, by the way. The governor of Hawaii and his wife, Mrs. Ho, get it, played by the lovely voice actress Lauren Tom, who plan a tourism campaign around North's bare child ass. Two grown adults in brown face pretending to be Eskimos, and one of them is Austin Danger Podcast legend Kathy Bates. And finally, a montage of additionally racist and disrespectful places. Throughout all these episodes, North is visited by Bruce Willis, who gives him some advice and ushers him along on the journey. Winchell and Belt, they try to do this tape. The parents are shocked at the divorce, and they stand rigid for like 2 weeks. And then when they wake up and get out of it, they are coerced into recording a tape by Winchell to give to North, edited in such a way that he would believe they didn't want him anymore. I can't believe that the kid at the beginning believes this, but he believes this. And also, in addition to that, like, they think he's dead, and then they hire a gunman, who I think is Dom DeLuise, who chases him around New York City, and finally he escapes to the National Association of Smoke Alarm People, or NASA for short, where he meets a bad comedian, also played by Bruce Willis, who teaches him the true lesson of the film, which, of course, as we all know, is... A bird in the hand is always greener than the grass under the other guy's bushes. It's a metaphor used by gardeners and landscaping people in general. After all this, it's all a dream. So fuck you, Rob Reiner's North. Mackenzie, when I picked this movie last week, well, when we talked about it on the Spinal Tap episode, and it has come up throughout the first 101 episodes of this show. Did you remember that it had come up at all, A?
No. When did it come up earlier?
It's come up throughout links, you know, links to stuff. And I've brought it up in Alan Parsons sometimes. But the movie is just called North. So if you don't know about it, it just disappears into the background, which for Rob Reiner was a huge win as he continued to work throughout the 90s and 2000s. And he's filming Spinal Tap 2 today, literally today.
Yeah, I mean, I'd never heard of this movie, so I think the times you've referenced it, I've never really understood what you were referencing. I just assumed it was a Kev reference I didn't understand, and I moved on. And
I do a lot of those, listeners. I do a lot of those.
The most has come up is recently, obviously, with Spinal Tap, and then you read this Roger Ebert review, and I did not realize this was notoriously like one of the worst movies ever made. Even Rachel didn't know, and I was trying to inform her, like, this is what we're watching this week, by the way. And all she could find on the Wikipedia was, it's been called one of the worst films ever made. So it's interesting that, like, I feel like I'm aware of infamously bad films, but North has been one that's just never really come up for me.
I've always been curious. But I've always known it's really bad. So I never really bothered. I think like, I don't know. I never feel, obviously Rob Reiner is a filmmaker who we love. We've talked about this on the Spinal Tap episode, but for maybe listeners, look, we pack this episode with other stuff. In retrospect, I feel subconsciously on purpose because it's a North episode. So, but if you don't know Rob Reiner's or you're new to movies or whatever, he's the director of, I'm just going to read these, Mackenzie. This is Spinal Tap, Stand By Me, The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery. Those were made all in direct order. A Few Good Men. He made a bunch of movies after this, but they were not as good as that stretch. That's an amazing streak.
Yeah.
And on paper, the idea of like Alan Zobel, who is a legendary comedy writer, I promise, wrote this children's book and they're doing a movie of it. That sounds great. This cast is a win. But the reviews were so bad that I just never thought about it. And even throughout the week, as I noted in our earlier segment, unless it got cut and maybe it should have, like, this was a torture ride for me. This was a nightmare ride to hell trying to watch this film. I found it like something about it magnetically was like excruciating.
It's not an enjoyable film to watch for sure. Like it feels like you're just being tossed around by the hands of God as you watch this film. And you're like, why am I here? Is life worth living? And it's I don't know, like I love bad movies. I don't mind a bad movie, but generally I like bad movies because they're entertaining, you know what I mean? There's some entertainment value to them. Like, you know, everyone, I'm looking at this article that was linked on the you know, the North page of worst films ever made, quote unquote, and you know, things like Showgirls and Batman and Robin and movies I love are in this category. But like, yeah, I was shocked a little bit by North because I guess I was expecting it to be a bit more oppressively bad, yes, a la Chairman of the Board.
I thought that it would be fun. But
it's not like, yeah, it's not like oppressive. Like at least Chairman of the Board was kind of fun to watch, dare I say. But this was just like boring and poorly edited and poorly written. And it is weird because the cast is amazing, especially for this time. Like these people, really, like a lot of these people at the peak of, like you mentioned, half the Seinfeld cast. I mean, they were huge in the mid-90s. Like, it's, the cast is incredible. Even Elijah Wood, I think, is doing a good job.
He's
here,
fantastic.
Dare I say. He's fantastic. He's a great child actor, I think. And I don't want to be disparage child actors. He's doing a way better job than the villain kid. I think that villain kid was just a little miscast for me. Like he was fine in the beginning, but he didn't quite for me handle the villain role, I think, as the film continued. But Elijah Wood is really solid at this young age, and I mean he's an incredible actor, so it makes sense that he was this good from such a young age. And so like I also like Bruce Willis in it. Like I think Bruce Willis is doing a great job. I think he's kind of fun and interesting. Like I don't hate the performances. I'm just confused by the movie because it's like so boring and also bad. It's just really, it is a mind fuck of a movie.
Yeah, so I think that's the issue, is the chemistry is all off. Like something about this thing, the core of it is just not right. And I think maybe that's where we should start, is diving in a little bit on this. Like it's supposed to be, so I mean you've seen Princess Bride, right?
Yes.
Princess Bride, tonally perfect. I think a perfect movie. Like totally yes. on the spot, exactly what you need it to be, exactly when you need it as a new viewer. And then it's a immediately warm sweater, lovely movie. When yes. Harry Met Sally, same thing. This guy, the rhythm, yeah. everything about it, even his debut, even when it was like, oh, Meathead made a movie and it's like a weird metal comedy thing. I think that movie's pretty perfect. Like, I don't know what it is here, but the chemistry's all off. The jokes aren't landing. The some of the jokes are for mm-hmm. clearly for adults. It has some of this. I would be interested to now go back to Shrek 2 in retrospect in context of North, because half of this movie is not for adults at all. I have no interest in like an evil kid along with John Lovitz. Like, why is that character? I mean, whatever, but like, why is he even there? And like, who are the jokes for? Is this supposed to be a movie for adults and children, or is this a movie for children? And they can't figure it out. It's way worse than like a Calvin Klein joke in Shrek.
Yeah, it's just there's just so much that doesn't land. I do think that it's like it's definitely a combination of things. I think a part of it is, yeah, they don't know who the audience is, clearly. And like, for me, I think also, like, I don't know, it's just they didn't take enough time. Like, this world of this movie is fantastical, right? And in the end, it's because it's a dream. So there's a lot of just kind of like fantasia happening. Like and I think for me, the film would really be better if, one, they took more time in the beginning to set up the world. Like, you just kind of show up at this table. They're relying on the Seinfeld cast to be funny enough for the parents to be into it. Elijah Wood doing the best he can, doing this weird heart attack thing with like the worst editing and the worst narration. Like, it just starts so bad. And it takes like, I don't know. I would have much rather have seen like more establishing of the family unit so that I give a fuck when they're reunited in the end. Like, there's no establishing of them as a family or what their hardships are or like why they maybe are parents who aren't paying attention to their kids. Like, I think that there could have been a lesson here, right? Of like, kids, you can't just throw your parents away, but parents, you need to respect and listen to your children. Like, there could have been a dual journey for parents and kids who watch this movie, but they didn't even care to like expand those characters enough. So it just throws you into the bullshit. And then like, by 5 minutes in, I kind of hate North because he's sitting around being like, I'm the perfect kid. Why the fuck don't they love me? I'm just going to divorce. And then like, you're just, for me, not on his side because the film has not established him or his parents or their relationship. So he's just this annoying little brat. And you're like, why do I care about what this kid's doing? Like, I think for me, if the tone of the fantasy world, or at least the a little bit askew world was done better, and if they had established the characters more, I think that would have elevated it at least a little bit more. Like, I felt like I didn't care about anything happening on screen, and that is just so hard to watch a movie when you don't care about anything you're saying.
Yeah, I agree. And I think a lot of these would have been solved with maybe some reevaluation of the scope and the voice and the tone. I think maybe if we bring it back down to North's level or make it more obviously like the revelation that it was all a dream. Now, obviously this is a farce, but like the revelation that it's not just stupid and it was all a dream was so like, I felt like a slap in the face. Cause like, I just spent the last 3 weeks trying to figure out this movie. And it was like, and it was all a dream for no reason. And then it's just solved. The problems in the third act are not resolved. Like, oh, what? They were busy that day and just having a bad day. And sometimes they have a bad day. So what about the entire middle part? What does racist Kathy Bates have to do with the rest of that? And I mean, there is a core string of it's going to be the same everywhere you go. Like, everyone's a little fucked up and you just have to navigate your way through the particular way. Like, sometimes if you want that, you have to navigate through that. But that was also not sold. I feel like something also, like, maybe there's 20 minutes that is the key to all this that just got cut. Like a studio mandate. Like, we need this thing to be like 95 minutes or however long. I don't know. I'm not him. Everybody seems like they have good humor about it now. 30 years later. But there's something missing and I'm lost in it.
You just pointed out something so great. Cause can I pitch to you my alternate ending for this film? If you're keeping the parents and North's relationship just needs to be set up better at the beginning. There's just no real setup for that relationship or dynamic. But if it's going to all be a dream and you're right, like the relationship needs to be earned again. Like what if they show up to the furniture place because they realized, oh my God, our son is missing. It's the middle of the night. He never came home. And they know about his spot. And he's like, you know about this place? And they go, yeah, of course we know, buddy. We know you. And he just maybe didn't realize that his parents, while being busy, stressed adults, do care about him, care enough to notice when he's gone and go to find him. And then they do actually reunite in the furniture store because the parents realize, like, we didn't realize we made you feel so unloved. And he didn't realize that they loved him the whole time. That's an ending that like it keeps pretty much the whole movie intact, but at least it makes the parents have an arc and like something mattered. Like you're right. It's just like, God, it really boils down to how fucking bad the writing and the structure of this movie is. It's just like mind-bogglingly bad. You just watch slop and nothing for an hour and a half. And then your life is worse after. I don't understand.
Yeah, it's just a barrage of like sub Borscht Belt stuff. The hammiest kind of like as someone who believes he is a hardcore comedy fan, I appreciated what was being gone for in like the hamminess of it and the kind of Borscht Belt kind of really goofy, like goofy puns. But again, as we keep hammering on, we're missing it. I think also, even though it is pretty outsized and very silly, like it should have been a little more obvious that this is a bit of a fantasy and getting out of control. Yes. Like I didn't know to take these people at face value or not. And I know that sounds crazy because this movie gets very silly and then very racist, but like, I don't know. Like, and then the biggest thing, and maybe this is okay, I like this as a stepping stone. What does it say about North that this is his world?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like what? I mean, by the time he's dodging bullets in New York City, it's obvious that we're getting somewhere with that. How weird. What kind of kid is this that's his world? These characters say these things and act like this? Like, was he raised in like a tin can on a train in the 1940s? Like, what are we doing?
Him being shot at with actual guns multiple times is absolutely bonkers. And yeah, like, I think this is going to sound so goofy, but I was sitting here trying to think of films that I feel like pull off an elevated, more fantasy world blended with real world that work for me. And you're going to laugh, but I think of the opening of Elf, like how sure. Elf, like it sells the sort of elevated fantasy of that opening sequence, or also Big Fish, which you and I were talking about offline. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like that film does a great job of balancing the real world with the elevated fantasy. While the elevated fantasy still feels real, it's also clear that there's some sort of fantastical element to it. Like, anyone who watched this film will be like, what are you talking about? Like, there's that part where like the Inuit grandpa gets like put on like, which I thought was funny, put on like an iceberg with like a TV and a chair. Like, that's very funny. And like these elements of like comedic elevated fantasy are there, but like, I don't know. It's like the tone of the film doesn't quite match it. Like I would have rather them, yeah, like gone harder maybe on the dreamy element of it, because yeah, it's like the tonally, it's just so disjointed that like by the time you learn it's all a dream, it just pisses you off because you're like, it didn't feel like a dream fully, so now I just feel like an idiot who wasted an hour and a half of my life.
Yeah,
it makes you feel like an idiot for watching it. I think maybe that's the ultimate like sin of this film.
It's like this stuff that was already fading off of people. Like, I feel bad, but these people are so rich and their other work is so good that I don't feel super bad. And this is maybe what have led people, some calling it the Argyle of its day. No, but the movie is like functionally broken and it's made by people who should know better. So I'm having this internal struggle of like, no kidding, North is bad.
Yeah.
But like
you can see where it could have been good, which is what's frustrating. Like you can see the elements that could have made an okay film, an okay kids movie, and it's just they didn't do it. And that's what makes you feel crazy.
There's a world that exists where if we were doing the show in 1994, Bruce Willis would get a supporting actor, Austin Nam. Just think about that. Like this is 3 years before Austin Powers is even an idea. And we would be that enthusiastic that we would have figured it out.
It's just confusing. Again, like I wrote so many times in my notes, like I can see a world in which this is an interesting film because like, I think the themes it's trying to tackle in terms of like kids, grappling with the fact that like, you don't really have autonomy when you're that little. And like, the dream is like, I'm a kid and I can just do whatever I want. I'm the most famous kid in the whole world. I'm the best kid in the whole world. I can fly across the world and meet all these different people. Like that is a fun fantasy that I think kids escape into when they feel not heard or misunderstood by their parents. Like, I think this could have been a really relatable, fun, like fantasy, but maybe it works better as a book. I don't know. Like,
I think I have
just it didn't work. I don't know.
I think I have it. Structure the story as a legal drama and the parents are in court and you can keep love.
Well, they do that. They try to do that.
They try to do that. But I mean like the whole movie is the trial. And then we can get into North's crazy world and then it's okay that it's a dream. I don't know. Anything else? Anything else?
I don't know how to fix this fundamentally broken film. Like it's just confusing. It's confusing more than anything else. I do not know what to say about it.
It's like, I don't know, man. It's like an alien watching a good movie. It's off. It's not like, you know, it's not like anything you've ever seen. Parentheses bad. I didn't think anybody, we had a couple people watch it.
Did they?
I think so. Yeah, we had a couple. Oh, my poor. If we could do.
Yes.
Elena gives 1 star. Baffling, just baffling. Absolutely cracked cast and director, and this movie just falls flat on its face.
That's it, man.
And that's it.
That's it. That's literally it. Yeah.
And that's it. You want to do popcorn?
I got so much fucking popcorn.
That's the thing, is that there's so much popcorn.
Yo.
How about North doing Fiddler on the Roof?
Okay, that was incredible. North doing Fiddler was the greatest thing ever.
That was like, all right, maybe I'll laugh at this movie. Because if you remember, The Love Guru was our death of comedy episode. We were wondering if America would ever find laughter again. And that's the difficult thing about North, is that the movie's actually pretty funny when it's not being horribly offensive or obtuse.
I mean, yeah, the first thing I really had was that Fiddler moment was amazing. I thought the heart attack thing was super weird because it also just like never came up again. Mm-hmm. I was like, great, what a weird fucking opening. I was just writing how much I was confused by the parents and the setup of the movie, which I've already talked about. Why are they doing these accents? Also, Elijah Wood's accent just changing throughout the whole film was really weird. Why is this Donnie Darko for kids? A bunny man talks to a young boy who believes he's the chosen one. I don't know.
Could have made it a sequel, Richard.
Yep. Donnie Darko is officially. Okay. What if in my mind, Donnie Darko is the sequel to North? Because I think that works really well, actually. I kept writing notes being like, I see a world in which this works and it's not this one. The company that sells pants, just exclusively pants, I thought was really funny. The various rooms where they test the types of pants, I thought that was a funny joke. Reba, gotta shout the queen out. I was exhilarated when she began singing because I am from Tennessee. I love Reba. I watched the sitcom Reba many, many years after school when I was in middle school. And I just also love Reba as a singer. So like when she began to sing, I was like, hell yeah, I love this. Like And Aykroyd's accent was actually pretty good. He like matched Reba really well.
I find that his problem is the movie's problem, where there's just something off. He's in the uncanny. This movie is in the uncanny valley, and he's like the king of it.
Yeah, but he did good. And his accent matched Reba's really well. Their song was, I thought the song was fun, albeit useless. And then this is when I wrote, like, yeah, Elijah like pivoted to a southern accent. I was like, dude, what are you doing? I did think Lovitz with the kids was very funny. Just like every scene where he was playing it dead serious to the children, I thought was very funny. Like, I thought that Lovitz did a really good job. This is the first line I wrote that was a little too adult for me, where they make a joke about Mrs. Ho being barren.
What was going on there, right?
And the butt crack thing of Elijah Wood going, so they could be close to my crack.
Okay, could we talk about the crack for just a moment?
Let's talk about the crack.
I famously DNF'd Rocky V. It's a really terrible movie. Okay. Even Sylvester Stallone is like, blah, 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 blah. He's going through a lot. Couldn't focus on Rocky V, but had to make it. Rocky V, 15 minutes. The first 15 minutes are all about Rocky's son's ass.
What
was in the water in the early 90s?
Nothing good.
To make us
nothing
think
good.
Nothing good. Poison only.
Poison.
That's Ronald Reagan for you. So anyway, Jesus, we're back Christ. To the butt motif. I thought that was, I mean, I understand what he's getting at, but again, that's just so indicative of the humor of this movie, which is so like he's looking at something in the room and like, oh, suntan lotion. Right. We're at a beach house. Right,
yeah.
Whatever. Oh,
but
suntan
also,
lotion. He's the kid in the suntan.
It could have just been that they were using him on advertising and then him feeling like he was being exploited by these people. And that would have just made more sense. Why did I don't even fucking know.
Could it be an inside joke between him and his kids? And maybe this entire thing is jokes between him and his kids. They all seem
we'll never
quite
know.
Racist. If so.
Bruce's fit on the beach, I loved.
Yes.
Loved Bruce's fit on the beach. The sequel to Kathy Bates Nude, Kathy Bates Brown Face, is here. The sequel. We love Kathy Bates. This was a poor choice. Poor choice to cast her as an Inuit woman. They did cast an indigenous actor. I don't believe he is Inuit, but they cast an indigenous actor as the husband. Then they cast Kathy Bates. It was just bad casting.
And then
I think,
the father was
generally.
Abe Vigoda.
Yeah, like it's just not great all around. But and we can move on.
I mean, we're all better now.
Yeah, there was a section again when he was going to China or he was going to Africa where I was like, oh, they're just fast-tracking offensive jokes, just bam, 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 immediately. And then this, like, five-minute section. The Africa one especially was, like, very adult and offensive. And I was like, great. Okay. Thought the kid being the villain again, really weak choice for me. This kid was, I don't want to say anything about him as a performer. Don't know who this child is. Wasn't quite doing it for me. Maybe a little miscast.
He's fine. I'm about to say something maybe not. Movie producers in the early 90s were looking for a particular type of kid. And this kid is absolutely like Macaulay Culkin.
Mm, I was about to say, was it Lipnicki? But yeah, you're right.
Lipnicki, also a guy who bears a striking resemblance to a Macaulay Culkin. Maybe.
Yeah.
Is that a hot take? I don't know. I don't even remember what
he
looks like.
No, I mean, but imagine a world in which they had just gotten, they were just able to get Culkin. It might have been a smidge better.
I'm sure they wrote it. Either that or the bad guy from the Little Rascals reboot.
I can't even find who this actor is. Like, what was this kid's name? Okay.
This actor will return to us in the Ice Cream Man episode. He appears alongside Clint Howard.
Wow. Love it.
Love it.
Love it. I did not notice little ScarJo until like right at the end when she had like a line at the train station. I was like, ah, little ScarJo. And also John Ritter. I feel like he's always cast as like idyllic fathers and everything. Cause he's in an episode of Buffy called Ted where he plays a very similar character, That character is evil. Womp womp. Also didn't even realize freaking, now kind of famously, embroiled in controversy, but Jussie Smollett was the little other little kid who gives him the tape. I didn't even notice that.
Oh yeah. Oh
until I'm
wow.
Looking
yeah,
at,
I didn't
until I'm looking at
either.
The cat. He's the kid who gives him the real tape near the end under the bridge. When he gets like actually shot at with guns, that started to get really weird to me. Like tonally did not work. I was like, this is too much. This is too much for this movie, and it's weird.
At this point, I was like, oh, it's going to be a dream, and that's why everything's so stupid. And it made me sad.
And then, yeah, like, the man fully trying to shoot the parents. I just was like, this whole return to the parents feels unfounded. We never saw the parents he actually cared about. They turned out of nowhere. And then the last thing I wrote was, this is so unsatisfying and unearned. LMAO was my last note. Kev, take me out of this. Take me out of my misery. Get those notes. Get those popcorn notes in my brain.
I got a couple we didn't cover. Let's take a look. I noted that there is the same glow we noted in our Hook episode here, which I noted as like the idea, I think, is like the warmth of a home, right? Mm. The kind of oranges, yellows, warm. Harry Potter, the Chris Columbus Harry Potters have a very similar feel, as does Chris Columbus. Well, Chris Columbus's kids movies all have this glow to them. Mrs. Doubtfire has it too. It's like a soft look. That started to feel like a dishwasher detergent commercial about halfway through the film. Ended up really working against it here, especially if it's going to be a dream. A lot of praise for Bruce Willis in my notes. A lot of praise for John Lovitz.
Yeah, he's great.
Arkin's doing, I noted he was doing some Groucho Marx stuff. This is from 3 weeks ago, so I don't remember what that note meant, but I'm sure it was great. So here's a flag. I think that Rob Reiner was trying to get at something with this, but unfortunately the consequence of this, the other end of the scale, is racism. So I don't know, but North getting a 34 out of 100 on geography, and his teacher's note just writing, how could this be, really like pause the movie, cracked me up. How could this be, really funny.
That's funny.
I wrote, the Hawaiian jokes are so hammy, and I'm just going to leave it there because it's a joke. Yeah. That's the kind of joke you would expect out of the movie North. And I wasn't even making it on purpose. So I love the staging of the musical number, but I don't remember that much about it. It's a comment. I called Bruce Willis on the beach the jazzercise Robin Williams. I thought the sequence when they send Abe Vigoda out to sea was Ari Aster-esque in its terror, in my opinion.
Whoa.
I love Bruce Willis as the hack comedian was great. I think that's my favorite phase of his. It's hilarious.
He was awesome in this movie.
But even Bruce cannot escape the confused tone. The jokes about how your balls stick to your leg in Miami because it's so warm. Or so hot right there.
The smoking joke.
Kenzo, please give me your final thoughts so we can end this episode.
Was that the last thing you had written down?
Yeah, I'm done.
I mean, there's no final thoughts. This is a confusing, befuddlingly bad film. It's not worth any stars. It's barely a movie to me, but it's one star because I liked Elijah Wood and Bruce Willis's performances. I think they deserved a better script, a better movie. I don't know who's to blame here. My brain wants to say the writer. My brain wants to say maybe Rob. I don't know. Nothing worked here, but the little bit of a shining pebble of something good almost exclusively came from Elijah and Bruce. So that's one star for them.
I started the movie with this note and I did not expect it to be like the whole thing, but sometimes you come in with an impression, it just becomes the whole experience. So I'm just going to say this. It's The Princess Bride as read by your creepy, weird, quote unquote, cool uncle instead of your grandpa. 1.5 for me. The stuff I liked too much to not note it in the score, but, the chemistry is all off here. Again, there's an alternate dimension where this is one of the great films of all time or whatever, but something in the water on this one just didn't work. Period.
Does not work.
Shall we move on?
God, please. We're almost free.
I love gold. And speaking of everybody hating this movie, this was obviously a big hit at the Razzies, but it did not win.
Wow. Okay.
I want to know.
Razzie's now, loser.
while it did win the 1995 Dallas-Fort Worth Film Critics Association Award for Worst Film,
okay,
it was only nominated in many categories. So I know this episode's been really long, but please indulge, because some of this stuff is going to blow your mind.
Hmm.
For example, Bruce Willis was nominated for Worst Actor, which I don't think is fair in North. I think he's one of the best. Like, doing parts the thing it, yeah. that works so well for him in comedy. I lost to Kevin Costner for Wyatt Earp, which feels like they had one out for Kevin Costner.
Good Lord. Yeah, wow.
Worst Director, obviously Rob Reiner was nominated, but Steven Seagal on Deadly Ground. Shout out to our former guest, future guest, Slim. Great job on that one. Worst Picture went to Color of Night, which I've never heard of, probably for good reason. A colorblind psychoanalyst is stalked by an unknown killer after taking over his murdered friend's therapy group, all of whom have a connection to a mysterious young woman that he begins having intense sexual encounters with. Bruce Willis, Jane March, directed by Richard Rush.
Bruce Willis, Leslie Ann Warren, Scott Bakula, Brad Dourif from the Chucky series. What a strange cast. Also on the Wikipedia, it says in last year it was streamed on the Criterion Channel.
2.5 on Letterboxd.
Kino used to have a 2-disc special edition, apparently, of this movie.
Oof. Anyway, all this to say, they couldn't even win the Razzies, right? Insane. Young Artist Awards nominated for Best Family Motion Picture Comedy or Musical. Matthew McCurley won Best Performance by a Young Actor Co-Starring in a Motion Picture. Elijah Wood lost.
Okay.
Wow.
He was, no Refutation. Offense, Elijah was way better than that other kid.
Refutation here. Let's see who Elijah Wood lost to. Elijah lost to Brad Renfro in The Client.
Okay,
Renfro. All right. Good job, buddy. But that's pretty much it. I Love Gold. Stinkers. Oh, they won the Stinker Award for best worst picture and worst actor for Bruce Willis, which again, I feel like was more for this Color of Night movie than this. Because again, he's doing the Bruno moonlighting persona quite well. Alan Parsons Project. This is the segment where we link the movie to the Austin Powers trilogy. I'm flagging here, but we're doing our best. This is just a lumpy, lumpy show. Obviously, Malcolm McNabb and Luis DiTullio are superstars.
Yes.
The actress Kelly Cooper, who appears in the Mel Gibson vehicle What Women Want, will never cover on the show. If you thought we were negative about North. I'll last call out Carol Kiefer in the art department. I'm thinking of her now and her work in the 2013 film Man of Steel as we start to speculate and see casting around James Gunn's new superhero films.
There we go.
There you are, you're over there.
We have no use over there, and thank the Lord, because we need to escape this North episode. I need to open my eyes and realize it was all just a dream. But if you would like to send us a letter or voicemail that we can share on the show next week, you know the drill. AustinDangerPodcast@gmail.com. Send us your mail. We will share it on episodes that are not centered around the film North. And that'll be just the best case scenario for everyone involved. We love you. Send us letters.
Wow.
And don't forget to vote at the Austins this year.
Yes, vote for the Stainies. If you're here, you've already done it, and thank you for it. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, if
far.
You're,
we love you.
If you're in the over an hour into the North episode, you're a real one for sure.
When am I going to resume my Kevin Smith journey, Kenzo? When am I watching Dogma? By the way,
when are you watching Dogma? When are you watching Jersey Girl?
Well, soon, but I have to get through the other two first. All right. Enough. Kenzo, it's time. Bring that wheel.
Let's
down.
Do
spin that wheel. What are we watching next week? Please. Good. Please. Good.
You said please. Good. And at least for you, I think it will be. Because currently you have seen this film. You have it logged on Letterboxd at 5 stars, Kev.
Okay. Well, that's not saying much. Protalexis, future guest, has dragged me through the town square, tarring and feathering me over that. But okay.
I'm going to say a couple things. I think you're going to be able to guess what the movie is. You have this rated at 5 stars. I have never seen this film.
Okay.
It is directed by one of the totemic directors of our podcast that we've covered many times.
Okay.
And it stars one of what many consider to be the greatest movie stars of all time, a favorite of our old pal Slim. Some actors? Might say the actor that our old pal Slim loves.
Totemic? Hang on. All right, let's crack this open. You know what's awesome about this, folks, is that an hour and 24 minutes, I'll dox the editing, 1 hour and 24 minutes into the recording, Kenzo's playing guessing games. Totemic directors. And okay, so it's Tom Cruise, and it's a totemic director
that we have covered many times.
Can you do me a favor? Could you give me another? Is this movie from the year 2005?
3 years earlier.
No, I didn't give that movie 5 stars. I didn't give War of the Worlds 5 stars. No.
I think you're on the right director, though.
But it's Minority Report.
It is Minority Report, yes.
Hell yeah. I love this movie. Oh, this is tight.
What?
You haven't seen
this? This poster has haunted me, and I don't know what it's about, or I don't know anything about this movie.
Yes,
I don't know the vibe.
My God.
I don't know what it's about. Max
von Sydow
is in this?
Have you ever seen The Fugitive? Have you ever seen The Fugitive, the 90s?
I have not. Should I watch that before I watch this?
We should.
Okay.
The Fugitive episode is going to be awesome. I'm very excited to cover that, but no.
Colin Farrell is in this?
Yes. He's excellent.
Whoa.
The reason I said that, and maybe folks who listen will agree, I'm listening, Silly Oswald, if you're listening, let me know what you think about this. They're very similar films in the structure, in that there's a whole movie that happens, and then there's like the reveal, and it's like a separate thing. It's so good. I'm so excited.
This is a sci-fi? Yeah. I think I thought this was like a crime thing, but it's a sci-fi movie?
It is
movie?
A crime thing. It's okay. A movie about the police in the future being able to predict murders. And it comes through these like billiard balls. So they have these red billiard balls.
This header photo on Letterboxd looks like a still from like Prometheus or something.
Oh, yeah. They go places in this film. I forgot all about this element. Yeah.
Oh, it's written by the guy who wrote Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Or the novella
it's
based off of.
Yes, it's a Philip K. Dick story. So it's got a lot of...
Interesting.
His stuff, I've found, Dick is probably one of the most like... prescient minds in sci-fi. Most of his stuff has come true in one form or another.
Total Recall was also Dick?
Yeah, correct.
What in the world? I feel like I've learned at least 18 things in the last 2 minutes now. Like, what's going on?
A Scanner Darkly, the Linklater film, is also Philip K. Dick.
What? Okay.
Yeah.
Good lord. I literally only know of Blade Runner. This is wild. I'm learning so much already.
As we enter hour 5 of this episode, I'm going to take it home.
Yes, please, take it home.
Minority Report, as of February 7th, 2024, is available on America's Network Paramount Plus, or you can rent it from the usual suspects. And if you have MGM Plus, because you're like somebody's kid who works there, you can check it out on there. But that is next week's episode. So excited. We're back to Steve. We're back to Tom. Minority Report. But until then, for Mackenzie, this is Kev. Awesome Danger Podcast. Peace.
If you want to find us on social media, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at Austin Danger Pod. This episode was mixed and edited by me, Mackenzie. Thanks for listening.